This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.
This podcast is a production of kcrw.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, Hollywood spin doctor Mike Citrick pays us a house call to talk about the recent epidemic of celebrity scandal. Plus, raising money in Hollywood for a Republican presidential candidate has never been harder. But first, the Hollywood News Caravan. It's The Business from NPR. Motion Picture Academy announced a rule change last week allowing a Best Picture Oscar winner to have more than three producers in, quote, rare circumstances. The move reversed an Academy rule that was intended to quash credit creep, that is, producer credit going to financiers, managers, and others who wouldn't know a gaffer from a best boy. The old rule limited each nominated film to three producers who could claim statuettes. This, of course, led to lawsuits from producers who felt they'd been denied a Best Picture Oscar, like Bob Yari, who was the executive producer of Crash 2 years ago. Also denied trophies, Brad Grey, the chairman of Paramount Pictures, and Brad Pitt, who both lost out on Oscars for their work producing last year's best picture, The Departed. Speaking of Mr. Pitt, Angelina Jolie rewrote a few rules of her own last week. The actress, who does have an Oscar, showed up at the premiere of her new film, A Mighty Heart, wearing a crushed velvet dress. The only problem was, it wasn't from St. John, the clothing label for which she's paid big money to shill. Instead, it was from a vintage clothing store on Melrose here in L.A. Total price? $26. A starlet's conspicuously inconspicuous consumption likely won't sit well with brands, considering what they pay for celebrity endorsers. Last week, Neutrogena added Jennifer Garner as their latest spokesmodel. She'll earn $1 million a year touting their Healthy Defense SPF 45 Daily Moisturizer. Memo to Jen, when you go to the beach, leave the copper tone at home. Finally, a Memphis, Tennessee projectionist may have lost his job for writing a negative review of Fox's Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer. Writing for the website Ain't It Cool News under the pseudonym Memflix, the projectionist claims that Fox was behind his employer's decision to suspend him indefinitely for reviewing the film before it was released, though the studio denies the charge. Meanwhile, Moriarty from Ain't It Cool News has leapt to his defense. Writing on the site, Moriarty says, quote, "Have I mentioned that 20th Century Fox can go bleep themselves? For a megacorporation that makes hundreds of millions of dollars a year, whether they're cranking out Dog Bleep or the occasional decent movie, they sure are a bunch of giant pussies when it comes to the slightest criticism of their films," end quote. Moriarty adds that when Memflix wrote his Fantastic Four review, Fox, quote, "went into hypersensitive overdrive. They tracked him down and had him fired, threatening to pull their business from the entire chain over that review," end quote. Our take? Theaters should require their projectionists to sign non-disclosure agreements, and Fox should chill out and make better movies. And as for Memflix, we look forward to his next review of Hardy's new Patty Melt Thick Burger. Mmm, tasty. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, apologies of the rich and famous. Celebrity scandal reached some new lows in the past year. There was Mel Gibson's drunken anti-Semitic tirade, Michael Richards' racist rant, Isaiah Washington's homophobic epithet, and Wesley Snipes' tax fraud indictment. And let's not even bring up the long list of more pedestrian starlet indiscretions involving booze and drugs and rehab and booze and divorce and jail and booze and bulimia and panties and lack of panties. While these events make for titillating reading for our celebrity spellbound society, it's serious business for the stars involved. Mel Gibson is a gross player and richer than, well, God, so he'll probably be okay. but it's unlikely that Michael Richards will grace your TV set anytime soon. And earlier this month, Isaiah Washington was dropped from the cast of Grey's Anatomy. The fallout from a celebrity faux pas will determine how steep a price the star will pay. To minimize that cost, stars often turn to master spin doctor Mike Citrick. The founder of Citrick & Company, which calls itself a strategic communications firm, Mike and his crew have become known as the masters of crisis management. His company's website boasts clients like Halle Berry, Kim Basinger, and Johnny Depp, and that's just under A to D. Many people say that Mike is a master of media manipulation and intimidation, and it seems he doesn't disagree. On the jacket of his 1998 book Spin, advertising mogul and Citrick client Dennis Holt calls him, quote, the godfather with connections and a typewriter. And maybe Citrick should be proud of his tough guy reputation. After all, if you get arrested, you get the toughest lawyer you can afford. Who's to say you shouldn't have a badass representing you if you're being tried in the court of public opinion? Mike Citrick, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
What are the basic precepts of crisis PR?
Well, the most important thing is, you know the facts before you open your mouth and know the facts before you develop a plan. Not only what you're going to disseminate, but equally important, if not more important, all of the facts of the situation. And information is power in our business.
Why is it not okay to just tell the simple truth? And have your clients ever rejected your PR plan in favor of telling the simple truth? And how's that worked out?
Well, we do tell the simple truth, but you have to tell it in a way that has an impact. We always tell the truth.
Well, I'm using the modifier, the simple truth.
Well, what is the simple truth? I mean, look, in journalism school, you're taught to ask who, what, when, where, why, and how. In our firm, we teach people to ask another question, so what? And so the simple truth has to answer the so what. And if you can say, is the simple truth, look, I had too much to drink. I shouldn't have been driving. I feel terrible about it. I recognize I have a drinking problem and I'm going to do something about it. And here's what I'm going to do. That's what we would tell our client to do. But many people would say the simple truth would be, you know, I had too much to drink. I shouldn't have been driving and I'm sorry. Well, that leaves a big unanswered question. What about the next time you go out to dinner or go to a party? Are you going to get behind the wheel? And I think those are important questions that need to be answered when you're dealing with a crisis.
In Hollywood, it seems like there are two kinds of approaches, even before we get to I'm sorry or this is what I'm going to do. But the first seems to be no comment. And it seems to be by far the most prevalent approach to crisis PR is to go armadillo, roll into a ball and hope they don't – you know, eventually they'll lose interest. The other theory is if you don't tell your story, someone else will. So you should help frame the debate. Which is your philosophy and are they ever mutually exclusive?
Look, sometimes you have to take your lumps and not comment. But with us, that's very much the exception, not the rule. The safest thing for a public relations person or a publicist to do is to tell their client, look, the media is evil. They're only out to get you. Don't comment. It's just going to make it worse. And then when a story comes out, they say, see, look at that evil journalist. And, you know, I don't think you're serving your client that way. About a decade or so ago, I published a book. And in the book, I said, if you don't tell your story, someone else will tell it for you. And that's true. There are three words that a pundit just can never bring himself or herself to say, and that's I don't know. And therefore, they'll opine on anything, whether or not they have any idea about which they're talking.
I remember watching coverage of the Michael Jackson trial. And at one point, you know, they were just sort of treading water that nothing was happening. As I'm sure you – I don't need to tell you. The wheels of justice grind slowly. And on this day, they were grinding particularly slowly. And one sort of commentator, talking head, was saying, we can't see what's going on, Jim, so we have no choice – but to speculate as if, you know, guns were pointed at their heads. We have to speculate. Speaking of scandals of that ilk, Michael Richards, Mel Gibson, Rush Limbaugh, Chris Albrecht, Don Imus, does it seem like there's more scandal now than there has ever been?
You know, people have been speculating for a long time about the impact of the internet. And if you want to see the impact of the internet, it is the proliferation of scandals. Not that the internet is causing the scandals by any means, but what happens is it's very easy to get information to a website, to have that website, especially if it's information about a celebrity, publish it. And the website then is picked up by the more traditional media, and hence you have the scandal. So you take Kim Basinger and Alec Baldwin's child and the tape that was leaked to TMZ. The question is, how would that story have played and would it have played if the internet weren't so prevalent today? And you can go Michael Richards. You know, you had the cell phone video go up on a website. Website then was picked up by the more traditional media, and hence you had the scandal there.
There's something about the richness of the medium, that it's interactive, that you can have the video, you can see it for yourself rather than just some, you know, description on the page. You can experience his rant. You can hear the phone call.
Well, you could do the same thing with television, but you don't have the immediacy. With less scrutiny than you would trying to get it on a local television station, in a local newspaper, or on a local or national radio station. And so, you know, you still have this scoop mentality where journalists want to break the story and everyone wants to scoop the competition. So something goes up on a website, the other media sees it, and they feel a need to get out there and report the story so they don't look like they're left behind in the pack.
How can you use the web to serve your clients' interests?
Well, we use the web quite a bit. You have to be very careful with the internet now to react quickly. So we have what we call a truth squad, and a truth squad is a group of people who monitor all of the media, the websites, the traditional media, for news on our clients. And when something pops up that is inaccurate, we immediately go to that website or go to that broadcast facility or go to that newspaper and demand a correction and show them why they're wrong. We had something that broke one time at midnight on AP on a celebrity client. And we, before we could even get to them, this was within minutes, it was on the CNN website. So we had one of our partners, who's a former city editor of a major daily newspaper, call AP and call CNN, pointed out what was wrong. The correction went up before it spread any further. So that's why you have to move quickly.
With so much money available to them and so many resources available to them, how is it that celebrity PR can go so wrong sometimes? I'm thinking of the Michael Richards appearance on The Late Show with David Letterman.
For this to happen, for me to be in a comedy club and flip out and say this crap, you know, I'm deeply, deeply sorry. And I'll get to the force field of this hostility, why it's there, why the rage is in any of us, why the trash takes place, whether or not it's between me and a couple of hecklers in the audience or between this country and another nation.
How can it go so badly?
First of all, the clients don't always listen to you. Second, there are a lot of incompetent people in my business. You know, there are a lot of people who do crisis PR who think it's just like any other PR, and it's not.
What's the difference?
We prepare our clients for a media interview the way a lawyer prepares his client or her client for trial. And we put them through mock interviews, and we even film them so they can see what they look like. It's a big deal. And it isn't taken lightly, especially something where the stakes are that high. And our questions will be much tougher than your questions would be because we'll cross the line to try to get a reaction out of them. And then when they react, we will explain to them how they need to react to make this right.
So you already know what their breaking point is.
Well, we try to push and see if they have a breaking point. And if they do, you know, then how do they deal with it? How do they deal with a question that's completely over the line?
And what is the standard answer you say when someone goes over the line? Is there a standard reply? Are you supposed to say, well, I'm not going to answer that?
It depends what the question is. It may be that you say, look, you know, I'm happy to answer that, but it has nothing to do with that which we're talking. Or you may want to say, look, I just don't feel it's appropriate to answer that. I'm sorry. And you know, what's your next question? But as you know, broadcast journalists will often use the pause to get a person to continue to talk. And so we'll have a conversation. You'll just wait to see if I keep talking as I'm doing now. And the tendency is to fill in that blank, and we have to explain to the client to say, okay, have you got any other questions?
I'm kidding. How is it different to do PR for a celeb or someone in the public eye versus a private person?
Well, it's interesting because the media seems to have an insatiable appetite for celebrity news. To the point where you think most people would say enough, but they can't seem to get enough of it. Therefore, every little twist and turn in a case about a celebrity tends to get attention. On the other hand, a private individual who is not used to the spotlight often has a much lower threshold of pain for reading about himself or herself. I explained to new partners in the firm that you really can't understand what it's like to be the subject of a news story until you're written about yourself. And the other thing that is more difficult for a private individual is it's often harder to get your point of view out after the fact. The media almost always will take news about a celebrity, so that if you want to sit back and respond to an allegation or respond to a comment a day later, you probably will get a second day's news cycle somewhere. But if you're a private individual and it's a one-day story, it's a one-day story.
It seems counterintuitive then, but you actually probably have to work harder for the lesser-known clients, and you have to work faster and pay more attention to them than the bigger names because your window is smaller.
You do, and you have to work harder to show the relevance of what the issue is and the relevance of what you're saying. I mean, if you take a look at the news stories on celebrities and you were to change the name to John Doe or Jane Doe, you'd say that wouldn't get coverage.
Is there a hierarchy in scandal?
There is a hierarchy, and the hierarchy is how much the public cares and how the public views the problem that the celebrity has. You can look at Michael Jackson, and you can, you know, who was accused of having relationships with underage boys. And then you take a look at Hugh Grant, who had sex with a prostitute. I mean, you know, does the public care about that? I don't think so. You know, and then you have the areas in between. You have how is the public going to react to Mel Gibson's comments? How is the public going to react to Michael Richards' comments? And as a public relations professional, you have to be able to gauge that and develop programs accordingly.
Okay. How long have you been doing this now?
Probably 37, 38 years.
Is it getting harder?
In some ways it's getting harder. In some ways it's getting easier. But you've got to be ever vigilant. You've got to be ever resourceful. And you have to really learn your trade in order to do what we do. This is not a place for on-the-job training. And we're dealing in some cases with people's freedoms, with people's lives, and with companies' lives. So these are important assignments, and we take them as such.
Any free advice for people in sticky situations?
Make sure you think before you act.
See, I set you up there.
Well, they can certainly call me or someone in our firm.
Mike Sitrick is the CEO of Sitrick & Company, a crisis communications specialist if there ever was. Mike, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, Republicans in Hollywood. They walk among us. You're listening to The Business from NPR. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. There are lots of names you can call Hollywood, but bastion of conservatism isn't one of them, which isn't to say that there aren't Republicans in show business. Among them are agents like former William Morris television head Sam Haskell, and creative types like Dennis Miller, Mel Gibson, Kelsey Grammer, Bruce Willis, and Clint Eastwood. Oh yeah, and let's not forget, Arnold. Nevertheless, it can't be fun raising money for a Republican presidential candidate in Hollywood, especially in a year when it seems like it's the Democrats' race to lose. Arizona Senator John McCain is said to be the Republican with the strongest ties to Hollywood. Variety even ran a story that he had had lunch at the Grill with Warren Beatty a few years back. MGM CEO Harry Sloan is perhaps McCain's greatest champion in Hollywood. Sloan's always been political. There are pictures of him with Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton in the White House on the credenza of his executive suite. But make no mistake, Harry Sloan is a rock-ribbed Republican. Harry Sloan, welcome back to The Business.
Thank you.
What's it like to be a Republican trying to raise money in Hollywood?
It's pretty lonely.
Is it really?
Yeah. Well, you know, I go back quite a ways of being a Republican in Hollywood. And I would say right now is maybe the lowest point of being in a position of raising money in Hollywood.
Why John McCain? What do you like about him?
I think he's the most principled political leader that our generation has produced. And that sounds like, you know, something that's like a canned answer, but that's how I introduced him when he came to my house about 4 months ago, and I had a lot of people over. That's how I introduced him when he spoke at a luncheon in L.A. recently. I didn't know John McCain personally, but when I came back from Europe and started, you know, paying attention to the mounting political campaign, I made it a point. I said, I want to meet John McCain. So I sought him out, and I never met him in my life until last summer, summer of 06.
How did you go about introducing yourself, and how did you wind up getting to know each other?
Well, I decided I wanted to be active in this presidential election, and the stakes are just so enormous. And I had some background working for candidates, in most cases Republican candidates. So I found a friend who was involved with the McCain campaign, and he arranged for me to meet the senator. He came out here to L.A. He was staying at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, and I went to his hotel suite and spent an hour, just the two of us. And, you know, everything I had believed about him was completely confirmed.
You have room service?
No, it wasn't a meal meeting. Uh-huh. It was a 3 or 4.
And how do you end it? Does he say, look, Harry, help me out here. They want to skin me alive in this town just for being a Republican. How do we shake the money tree?
The money tree is sort of interesting. I said, you know, where do I sign? Where do I send the money? And, you know, he said, well, we haven't announced our candidacy yet, and we're not able to, you know, raise money. And I have this PAC, but it's already got all the money it needs. I don't take corporate jets, and I don't take rides, and I don't take any of that stuff. So really isn't much you can do for me now. And when we announce the candidacy, let's take a look then. You know, fundraising is hard for him. I mean, he's sort of embarrassed by, on one hand, being so much against what the fundraising, how the fundraising works to corrupt the system, and you know, and part of that same hand, being one of the few people who doesn't take rides on corporate jets, and you know, stands by all those principles. But yet at the same time, because of the way it works right now, he has to raise money. I think that's one of the reasons that he fell behind the other candidates. His heart isn't in it. His heart wasn't in it. It needs to be in it now, and it has become more in it. But he's never going to be, with all due respect, Bill Clinton, who's, you know, really loves going out and raising money.
And who loves flying on private jets.
Well,
I mean, he's, you know, on Ron Burkle's private jet, yeah, probably once a week, it seems. Yeah. At least that seems to be the scuttlebutt.
Yeah, I think he paid his dues.
No question there.
Yeah.
What is your job when you host a cocktail party at your home in Bel Air?
Yeah, the event we had was to bring in people who may have met him along the way or who hadn't, to become fundraisers and to get to know him. It was a broader event. It wasn't a fundraiser. I have since been to a fundraising lunch that he had. I think it was also at the Beverly Hilton where I introduced him. And it was moderately successful, and there were some people that came out of the Hollywood and media community. We're getting a few people to contribute, but you know, not to the extent that I think he can eventually attract, and certainly not to the extent that he would have attracted in 2000 or 2004 if it weren't for the issue of the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm. Well, that Yeah, that's sort of a big if.
It's changed everything in terms of how easy it is to sell John in Hollywood right now.
Take us inside that scene, inside your house. Who did you invite? How many people were there? What was your criteria for selecting them?
It was
how does that work?
Most of the people were selected by the campaign. It was early on.
You don't just stop at Smart and Final and pick up a deli meat platter and say, you know. There's a lot of, I would imagine, planning that goes into this. Tell me about it.
Well, you know, as far as the food's concerned, you know, none of these events or fundraisers are much better than the Smart and Final deli platter because, you know, whatever you spend is paid for by the campaign, and wasting it on, champagne for people visiting a presidential candidate's reception is certainly not as wise as saving it for TV time. So the food is never very good at these. The McCain campaign actually worked with me. I invited some people, I don't want to mention names, but some people from the entertainment industry who were willing to come over and take a look at John, and I think he did well with some of them. Actually, I think he did well with all of them.
Your event did not raise money? Was it just a...
The event at my house was not a fundraiser. It was for the purpose of recruiting people who would make a commitment to become active in the campaign fundraising. There was a subsequent event, which was a luncheon at one of the hotels, where several hundred people came, and some of the people were drawn from the crowd who'd come to the event at my house.
How'd you do in terms of the final tally of money?
Think that was maybe $250,000 at about 1,000 a head or something like that, maybe 200-300 people.
You are the CEO of MGM and MGM Studios, and I would imagine that having vast experience in the marketing and distribution of motion pictures, you might have something to say on the subject of how you open a campaign, so to speak, and how you market a candidate. After all, what you spend on a big MGM picture might be what someone would spend to become president.
You know, in the early days, some of his people were around, and some of the senior people we got to know a little bit, and they were looking for, you know, some help and some advice in those areas. But the other area that I think we were able to have some discussions with them, I don't know how far or how valuable, but was in getting together their online strategy. Because the new media strategy, of course, is more important than it ever has been, and, you know, we're all involved in that as well. So, yeah, we were able to give them a little bit of help and would continue to give him as much as we could in terms of marketing, in terms of his website, in terms of anything that we can do.
What happens next for you? How many more of these Smart and Final cheese cube platters are in your future?
I mean, I'd like to throw as many as I can. I mean, I'm so committed to this campaign. I only know so many people. And most of my friends, as I think you've surmised in the Hollywood community, are Democrats. And right now is not a great time to be doing it. But I think there'll be another chance. But I really want to be there and try to host anything I can for him.
Are most people in the end in Hollywood big givers, big fish donors, so to speak, pragmatists at heart? That is, that the Rupert Murdochs of the world contribute heavily both to the Republican and to the Democratic Party just to make sure that however this thing goes, we're covered.
I think that's a little unfair when you say that Hollywood works that way because, I mean, you know, the bulk of Hollywood are people in the creative community. Actors, writers, directors, producers, and not, you know, the few of us that are studio executives. And I think out there, I think people decide who they want to support, who they believe in, and then they give them money. And they are big givers.
Harry Sloan is the CEO of MGM and potentially the next Secretary of the Treasury under President McCain. Harry, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks very much.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Darby Maloney is associate producer of our program. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.